Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And welcome back to the Final Inspection Show. Steve Zottke along with David Hobbs at Road America in NASCAR weekend. And what says NASCAR more than David Hobbs? Well, you know, it's funny. People,
I say I'm laughing, but I did 18 Daytona 500 for CBS. So.
And you also drove the 576 and drove another race for Junior Donlevy at Michigan.
Right.
In which you made the cover of the Midwest Racing News back then because you had you lost a tire, I think, or something.
Well, I drove for old Junie, and I hadn't done very well. Well, I did okay at Daytona. I mean, I finished eighth in the 125-mile qualifying race. Which put me on the eighth row. But then in the race, the link to the rear sway bar broke, which put too much weight on the front, and the right front popped going into turn one, and I hit the wall, just scraped it. Didn't do a lot of damage. But the mechanic I had at the time with working with Benny was not exactly what you'd call... he wasn't exactly Toto Wolff. so we put the car behind the wall in the end. And then I drove again. This is Coca-Cola was sponsoring me in both these events. And I drove with Junie in his Ford at Michigan. And of course, his main driver was Dick Brooks in the 90. The 90.
And you drove the 9.
Is it the 9?
Yeah.
The 9 car?
Yeah.
Anyway, we qualified in about the middle of the pack. But something about the track, the car, me, the day, whatever. I mean, I'm passing people right, left, and center, you know, including Benny, and a whole bunch of others. And suddenly, I realised I'm third behind Darrell Waltrip and Cale Yarborough. I thought, what the hell am I doing up here? So what do I do now? Anyway, it was all resolved, because coming off turn four, I spun the thing. And it went through a complete 360 loop. And of course, four is just right by the pit in. So it spun around, facing the right direction, into the pits, and pulled out in front of the pits. Junie Donlevy looked through the curtain, the net, and he said, "That's the finest bit of driving I ever seen." And I said, "Oh, well, Junie, it's just, you know, comes naturally." I mean, my heart was doing about 1,000 beats per minute. Anyway, things really, because that brought out the yellow, and things really started to unravel then, because unfortunately they didn't tighten up the right rear wheel properly. So I had to do a slow lap with the wheel flapping about. Luckily, it didn't fall off. So now I am a lap now. However, I kept plugging on, and I'm getting hot. And it was 1976, and I hadn't done much driving in 1976. My IMSA days were more or less, well, for that, no, I hadn't even started IMSA. I was sort of in a bit of a transition period between drives. And so I was getting tired. And it's Michigan in June.
In the summer, yeah.
God, it's about 100 degrees, about 130 in the car. And my neck was starting to give out with the G-load. And I knew that Dick was out. Not quite sure how I knew he was out, but I realized he wasn't anymore. So when I came in for my stops, I'd say, every time I came, I'd say, "Junie, do you want to put Dick in the car? I mean, put Dick in the car." And he said, "No, boy, you're doing fine. You're doing just fine." And I said, "You silly old twit, you're not getting what I'm getting at. What I'm really trying to tell you is I want to get out." Anyway, I kept going to the end. I don't know where I finished. Because afterwards, I mean, I'm like a wet rag. I take my suit off to my waist, and I'm sitting by the truck, sweat just pouring out of me. And old Junie comes up, and he says, "Boy," he said, "I thought you was going to win that thing." So, unfortunately, Junie's no longer with us. But, I mean, that's the sort of guy that made NASCAR what it is.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was, you know, right in at the beginning. Big friend of Bill, Big Bill. And I mean, he was an amazing character. But of course, I did actually drive a stock car on my very first visit to an American racetrack when I came over to do the Continental 3-Hour in 1962 in a Jaguar XKE for a chap called Peter Berry. And we were invited by Big Bill, as were a lot of people from Europe. Sterling Moss came, a whole bunch of guys from England. Innes Ireland was there, and Jimmy Clark was there. And Jimmy Clark drove my Lotus Elite, which had Dad's automatic gearbox in it, which in its day was very advanced because it had four stepped ratios. And it didn't have a fluid drive, it had a friction clutch. So it operated just like a modern automatic. You could change it up and down by hand or just put it in fourth and it would do its thing. And it didn't use any power or, you know, very minimal power to run a couple of little pumps. And it was very successful. And Colin Chapman, who probably was at that time probably the most inventive Formula One guy, developed the first monocoque Formula One chassis, developed the best suspension. And he could see that an automatic would probably be the way to go eventually. Well, you know, fast forward 40 years and they're all automatic. And he asked me back in like November, he said, hey, there's this new race in America, a 3-hour race. Could we borrow your Lotus Elite for Jimmy Clark to drive? So Jimmy was driving my Elite and I'm driving the XKE. The XKE, the fuel pump broke very early on and I was out. And Jimmy was leading the class by miles in my car. Unfortunately, it's a 3-hour race, so he had to stop for fuel once. And the blinking thing wouldn't start. The starter motor got fried and it wouldn't start. But the entrant, Peter Berry, my entrant, had spun old Bill a huge line of cock and bull about that I'd won this championship and I'd driven sedan cars and I'd won this and I'd won that and I'd barely started really in 1962. Anyway, so old Bill says to me and Jim, how'd you like to try a stock car, boys? So I drove a Holman and Moody Galaxy in practice, as did Jim. And we both turned laps. I think in those days it was about 150.
Right, yeah.
And the pole that year was probably Fireball at about 155. So we, because I'd been driving my Lotus Elite all the season, I'd only ever driven a Jaguar XKE at Daytona. So that was probably the first time I ever went 150. It was in the E-Type going down the back straight with no bus stop. And of course, averaged 150, and as I say, I'd barely ever been much more than about 120, 130 before in a race car because I only drove little cars. So, anyway, luckily, Dan Gurney, who had won the 3-hour in the RC Aero Brothers Lotus 19, he was hovering around, and of course, he was already pretty much a forward driver. So, luckily, they put him in for the race. But I did stay on and watch the race.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I watched the race. Much to Margaret's disgust, because we'd only been married a month. And Greg was well and truly on the way. So I stayed over for another week. I think then the races were only like 1 or 2 weeks apart.
So did you then drive back to New York? Because you flew in from England to New York. Did you fly out? Do you remember? On to New York? Or?
The return trip is absolute complete blank. I can't remember. I might have flown out of Miami. They did fly to Miami, though.
Yeah.
They certainly didn't fly to Orlando.
The BOAC?
Yeah. I might have flown out of Miami. Honestly, I just can't remember how I got home. But in the week or 2 weeks between the 3-hour and the 500, I became a bit of a pal of Fireball Roberts. And I think his girlfriend's name was Judy. Cute little blonde girl. And I went out with him two or three times. And, of course, in those days, we used to go, there weren't that many watering holes in Daytona, but we visited them all. And I remember one day at the corner of Beach Street and what was then Volusia Boulevard, it's now Bill France Boulevard, the main street in past the racetrack, where it crosses Beach Street right downtown. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning and Fireball pulled up in the middle of the road and turned the radio up on the car. And me and Judy were dancing at the intersection of Beach Street and Volusia Avenue at 2 o'clock in the morning in early February 1962.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How the hell do I top that?
with difficulty. Because the other thing that I was fascinated by, I was staying at the Carousel Motel, and I shared a room.
On the beach?
On the beach. It's gone now. It's right. up towards the Ormond end.
Okay.
It's gone now. And Jimmy Clark and I were sharing a room. And my opinion of Jimmy, of course, had changed dramatically because in the winter, there used to be a thing called the Springbok Series, which was for Formula One cars. And they went all over Southern Africa, to South Africa, to Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, out to Durban in South Africa, up into Lorenzo Marx, which was Portuguese East Africa, is now Mozambique. And he had beaten my real hero, Stirling Moss, twice in the Formula One. Now, Lotus, I mean, Stirling was driving a privately owned Lotus.
For Walker.
Yeah. And, of course, Jimmy was in the factory car. But he had beaten him twice, and I thought, oh, boy, you know, this guy must be pretty good. And we shared a room. And one day, because we were both pretty amazed at the fact that cars were driving on the beach, and one day some dork got just a bit close to the water, and the next thing is the thing's up to the hubcaps in water, and then the tide's coming in. I thought Jimmy Clark was going to have a heart attack laughing so much at this poor idiot in the water with his car. And also, that was just right around then. Skiffle was a form of music in England, and I suppose here, you know, which is pretty simple. A couple of guitars and a washboard, you know. And there was a chap called Lonnie Donegan. And one of his first big hits was a thing called Rock Island Line. She's a mighty fine road, she's a mighty fine road to run. And bugger me, there I am going from the Carousel Motel to the track. And, you know, you cross all those level crossings in railroad crossings in town, in Daytona. And there goes by this train with the Rock Island Line on the freight cars. And I thought, well, I'll be blowed. There really is. I just thought of it as a sort of a line from a song. And there it was. There was a real Rock Island Line load of freight trucks going by.
See, our friend John knows that because he's a big train expert, Rock Island Line.
Oh, well. We need a few train experts around at the moment, actually. But so, yeah, my NASCAR career was short, relatively uneventful, and it was quite good fun. I mean, you know, we're driving at somewhere like Daytona. Obviously, these cars now are incredibly aero. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys spend more time in the wind tunnel than Formula One people do because it's sort of got to have the silhouette and it's kind of got to look like the real thing. But
right,
because, you know, the template's got to fit. But at the same time, they massage every little tiny curve and tweak around where the wheels and the fenders, you know.
And then when they do find something, they get yelled at.
They get yelled at. But, I mean, they do spend a lot of money and a lot of time in the wind tunnel. And, of course, those days, that Ford Galaxy was about as basic. I mean, it was a Ford Galaxy right off the street, you know, with a bit of a roll cage in it.
Well, up until the late 80s, early 90s, the hood, roof and trunk was stock.
Well, there you go.
And then the windshield was too, and then they would add a Lexan thing on top of the windshield.
Yeah.
But those were still stock items.
Yeah. So, you know, it's obviously come a hell of a long way. And like a lot of racing, I mean, a lot of the changes they've made, I'm not sure whether they're for the best or not. But I tell you what, Bill France was an incredible individual. Because one of the other British drivers that came over was Stirling Moss, who drove a short wheelbase Ferrari 250 GT short wheelbase, which currently go for about $30 million.
Yes.
And can't remember what happened to him in the race. And I think Fireball drove a Ferrari too. Did he have Ferrari? Or
he did a lot of road racing,
yeah.
But that was a thing where, you know. Big Bill knew he was a fan, and he wanted to make Daytona an international track.
Exactly.
That's why he brought everybody over.
That's exactly why he did it, and that's exactly how the 3 hour morphed into the 12 and then the 24 hour, because Big Bill wanted to internationalize Daytona, and he did a pretty damn good job at it too, him and his son. Because, you know, it's always looked at now as the sort of first race of the year, the first big race, and everybody that lives in Europe and even up here in North America, can't wait to get to Daytona in February because it's a great race. It's a great place.
Well, and, you know, and throughout the history of the track and race, there was always, because it was an FIA race, it was open to drivers who had an FIA license, yeah. which that's how you got in 76. But yeah. any driver, you know, drivers have done that in the past. I think Jackie Eakes even drove it 1 year, and the Whittingtons and another driver throughout.
Rick Elford driving it.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
the Frenchman, it was, what's his name? Gosh.
Yes, I know who you're
very
talking
Very tall guy, and Big Bill and he got very close together. But Bill was very astute, him and his wife. I mean, they ruled the whole thing with an absolute rod of iron. You remember all that stuff at Talladega when the drivers
right.
didn't want to race there, and he said, well, I'll drive it myself if I have to. And Charlie Glotzback won it, who nobody's ever heard of before or since.
No, Charlie. No, he did, Richard Brickhouse.
Oh, was it?
Yeah,
I thought it was Charlie Glotzback. Okay.
But I mentioned Charlie last week because he still holds the qualifying, or he holds record at. Boy, just last week I mentioned it on the show. I can't think of it at some track they were at. But anyways, he still holds the race record. Oh, Bristol.
Oh, does he?
When they're at Bristol, he still holds the 500-mile. 500 lap record at Bristol from 1971.
Good grief.
I know.
That's amazing.
And he's still around, doing well.
Well, the.
Not bad for a guy who got shot.
That's right, yes. yeah.
Him and Bobby Johns, I think, are the only guys I know who got shot.
Oh, well. Hanging out with the wrong crowd again.
But,
I mean, the track, you know, Daytona was, you know, you look at it now and you look at it then. I mean, the difference was quite amazing. But. Bill had worked all the usual assets for the tax, you know, getting a tax rebate to put the track there. Now, of course, it was then right on the edge of town. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it's right in the middle of town. And I gather the local authorities have been a bit pushy about trying to get some of their money back or not getting such big breaks and all sorts of things like that. But he had a vision, and, you know, he wanted to get aligned with Le Mans. He liked Le Mans. Mm-hmm. And of course, I started doing the broadcasting. Now, Big Bill... Probably his only slight weakness was, you know, when they wanted to do the Daytona 500, he wasn't that keen. I mean, Ken Squire had pushed
Oh, you mean
him.
The live? When they went live, you mean? Or
Yes.
Okay.
He was not that keen on that live TV stuff because he thought it would take away from the gate.
So sure.
It was blacked out in Florida. It was blacked out in Georgia and Alabama and the Carolinas. And, I mean, it was absolutely... You know, Ken had pushed CBS for years, and it was absolutely the best thing that NASCAR ever did was to have that live race because it drew an audience of 6 or 7 million people, none of whom had ever heard of NASCAR before, and it put it right on the map. And you look at the TV income they make now. So he was very visionary, but he just had a bit of a blank spot on that. He couldn't quite figure out that this was going to be so good for them. Then I started doing the commentary from the very first one, the 79 one, with the big fight at the end. And, I mean, talk about a dream come true. The race
and you had the big blizzard up north. Everybody was snowed in.
Blizzard up north. And there were a lot of other games were canceled or not held at all, or it was just on an off Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly you got about 6 or 7 million people watching it who probably wouldn't have normally been watching the TV on that afternoon. The race was okay, but Cale and Donnie had got it all wrapped up and were running way out front, just head-to-head, two of them. Then on the last lap, I can't remember who was leading who, but...
I think it was Donnie, because Donnie really wanted that. Donnie had won races, but he never won any of the big races, and I think he really wanted to win that.
He dropped down to block Cale, and he went further and further and further, practically in the grass. And then they hit each other and spun up and hit the wall on the outside of turn three and then spun down onto the apron and got out and immediately started fighting. At which point, our hero, Richard Petty, who's lying a very distant third, comes through and wins his 200th Daytona 500. So, you know, a huge part of the crowd just loved Richard Petty winning the race. Meanwhile, these other two coves are fighting. Cale's taking his helmet off. And as you know, Cale had the sort of the comb over of all comb overs. So once he took his helmet off and he's fighting, his hair's all flailing in the wind and he's hitting Donnie with his helmet. And then on the slowing down lap, of course, big brother Bobby arrives on scene and he jumps out of his car and he joins in the fight. And Ken Squire is just about having a heart attack in the booth. And I'm there with him. And I mean, it was absolutely just. A storybook ending. You just couldn't get a better... And, of course, suddenly everybody's electrified by this NASCAR. And been like that ever since.
Yeah, it certainly has. Well, David, you know, I thought, I know I can get some NASCAR stories out of them, and certainly have. It's been a delight having you on the show. At Road America, who would have thought when you first came here in, what, 64 or whatever, that, you know, 50 years later, we're talking NASCAR at Road America.
I never even thought when I came in 64 that I'd be alive in 50 years, let alone talking about NASCAR. And look how this track's changed, too. I mean, my God.
Well, it's changed, but the track itself has not, but everything else has. I think that's the beauty of it.
That is the beauty of it. The other thing that's quite amazing for this track up here in the north is how smooth it always stays, in spite of the winters. A lot of other northern tracks like Watkins Glen, Lime Rock, the winter beats the hell out of them. But here, it's all shale around here. This part of the world is all shale. And which is what this place was going to be. It was going to be a mine, a quarry. Cliff Tufte, who owned it, and they had the road race in the streets. And the governor finally said, whoa, this looks a bit dangerous to me. You know, XK120 is doing 120 mile an hour past 100,000 people standing in the grass. And so Cliff Tufte stepped up and said, well, I'll tell you, well, I got 800 acres. Let's turn it into a racetrack.
And he patterned the track after some of the pattern of that original track, which you can still follow today, thankful to the historic Elkhart Lake Preservation Society, who has a dinner a couple times a year, which you've spoken at, and which supposedly I'm supposed to speak at one of these times.
Oh, my God, I kept telling John Callahan, I said, do not on any account have Steve Zock here.
Hey, Watkins Glen had me for some reason, so, you know. But yeah, no, it's fascinating, and people don't. And one of the other story is with Elkhart Lake itself, which was a boom town before the war in the 20s and 30s, vacation town, because it was just far enough for Milwaukeeans and people from Chicago. But after the war, they really struggled, and they did not have the holiday people that they had prior to the war, and that first race in 50 was a way for them to bring people back to Elkhart Lake, and it's really worked for them.
Well, Elkhart Lake is a really charming little village. It's very pretty. It's got some great restaurants and, you know, off the rail, the coffee bar there, which everybody assembles at. And it's become a very touristy town. I was just out last night, and the place was absolutely full of people. And obviously, it's got a lot to thank this track for that.
Well, I'm being told by my producer we've talked long enough, so it is time to. Yeah, we've been. Boy, I think we're on overtime here. So, David, thank you once again, and looking forward to chatting with you again.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, David Hobbs on the Final Inspection Show, brought to you by the legendary Great Lakes Dragway in Union Grove, and of course, David Hobbs Honda.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.